welcome to this Tuesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Republic. We are glad that you are with us today. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in just a bit, more on the now clouded history of the Marquis de Morez. In his Plainsfolk essay, Dr. Tom Eason explores how new scholarship now challenges his long-celebrated legacy. Plus, new federal restrictions on the herbicide dicamba are intended to reduce damage caused by spray drift, but many farmers, researchers, and conservation advocates say the changes won't end the controversy. And we'll stay on the theme of agriculture as Main Street begins today. North Dakota farmers are facing mounting financial pressure from rising fertilizer prices, higher equipment costs, trade uncertainty, and global conflicts that are driving up the cost of doing business. North Dakota Farmers Union President Matt Perdue joins Prairie Public CEO John Harris on a recent edition of Prairie Pulse to explain how international events, from tariffs to tensions in the Middle East, are impacting farms here at home, what it means for producers, and what policy changes could help strengthen the future of family agriculture.
Hello, and welcome to Prairie Pulse. Our guest joining us now is the North Dakota Farmers Union President, Matt Perdue. Matt, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks a lot for having me on. Happy to be here.
Well, as we get started, we always do, tell the folks a little bit about yourself, your background, maybe where you're from.
Yeah, well, I've been serving in this role for about 6 months now. I was honored to be elected president of North Dakota Farmers Union back in December. Farm with my family near Ray, North Dakota. We raise spring wheat, durum, canola, lentils, soybeans. And I spent a big chunk of my career working in public policy, advocating for family farmers and ranchers. I spent 6 years on the staff at North Dakota Farmers Union, spent a few years actually working out in DC for National Farmers Union, worked on the 2018 Farm Bill, and have a lot of experience at the state and federal level working on a lot of the issues that we're talking about today.
All right. Well, so let's start off with, what is the North Dakota Farmers Union? Give us some history on it.
So we are a general farm organization. We're committed to the advancement of family farm and ranch agriculture, quality of life in rural communities, and for all people. And we achieve those goals through three pillars: cooperation, education, and legislation. Earlier this week, I was out at one of our Farmers Union camps welcoming a group of third grade to sixth graders who are enjoying a lot of lessons about the cooperative business model, growing as leaders, meeting a lot of friends from across the state. Our education programs are very strong. We're obviously very strong advocates for family farmers and ranchers in the state capital in Bismarck and out in Washington, D.C. And then we have a lot of work with farmer-owned co-ops, local cooperatives across the state of North Dakota, making sure that our cooperatives remain strong and can serve their members. We're excited this year to be celebrating our 100th anniversary convention. We were founded in 1927. And, you know, we have a strong organization, strong traditions, strong membership. And again, so honored to lead this organization and to create value for family farmers and ranchers across the state.
Yeah. So what is your role? I guess you've got you as president. What's your role as president, and do y'all have staff, or is it just you?
Yeah, we have an incredible staff based in Jamestown there. As the president, I have the opportunity to lead those staff and really execute on a lot of the direction we get from our members. Obviously spend a lot of time visiting with our members across the state, every corner of this state. I told you earlier, I'm from the northwest corner of the state, and tonight I'll be with some farmers down in Lidgerwood in the southeast corner of the state. And so spend a lot of time visiting with our members, trying to understand their challenges, and really working together to develop solutions and advance those solutions for family farmers and ranchers, for our neighbors, and for our members across the state.
Yeah. Well, with that said, we're here today to talk about some of those challenges. And due to, I guess, overseas conflicts, especially in Iran, I guess, for now. One of the challenges is the price increase to fertilizer equipment and of course, fuel. Have there been reports on North Dakota farmers experiencing the impact?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there have been a lot of impacts from geopolitical tensions, I would say. You know, we have the trade disputes with China and with other trading partners that has impacted demand for a lot of the commodities we grow. Soybeans was a hot topic, remains sort of a hot topic in that arena. And we have the Iran conflict, the Iran war, whatever you want to tag it. But the closure of the Strait of Hormuz is creating significant upward pressure on input costs. That's impacting farmers right now. It's going to impact farmers and ranchers in the next year, I'm afraid. And so I think farmers and ranchers across the state are feeling these pressures. There are some who are feeling it much more acutely than others.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we think about fuel all the time, but what is the causing rise in the farm equipment?
Well, so if we go back to 2025, this administration has been very aggressive with their tariff strategy. And that has included tariffs on steel and aluminum. And those tariffs on steel and aluminum have constricted the supply of steel and aluminum products, which are used to make farm equipment, right? Farm machinery. And so that certainly has driven up the cost of machinery, driven up the cost of replacement parts. And then you have producers across the northern tier of the state where there's a lot of equipment, a lot of purchases, a lot of business that happens across the Canadian border. Now, things with Canada and Mexico have calmed some. We're reviewing the USMCA really right now. But some of those restrictions, some of those tensions with our North American trading partners also have created a lot of confusion, a lot of increased costs for producers who do a lot of that cross-border trade.
And MCA?
USMCA, U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement, NAFTA 2.0.
There you go. Yep. I just want to define it for people. Can you expand on, you know, the rise in these prices, how they affect a farmer in North Dakota or the Midwest, I guess?
Well, this last year, with the Strait of Hormuz, with that closure, which really hit in early March, you know, a lot of fertilizer, you look at the nitrogen fertilizer, urea, anhydrous ammonia, those costs have increased about 40%. Well, your fertilizer inputs are, for most farmers, a third, 40% of those input costs. And so that 40% of your input costs are increasing by 40%. That's a significant hit. Now, fortunately, heading into this year, there were a lot of farmers who had prepaid, who'd booked their fertilizer in advance of that, who'd locked in a price. There's a group of farmers who certainly when they saw this conflict start and they saw fertilizer prices start to rise, they jumped on it right away and booked their fertilizer. I think my biggest concern is, you know, there's still a group, 10, 15, 20% of producers who did not pre-book fertilizer. The ones who are unable to book their fertilizer in advance, in most cases, are the ones who are facing the most financial pressure and are having trouble trying to figure out how they were going to get together their operating capital with their lender. And so those folks who are most vulnerable, in a lot of cases, are the ones who took the biggest hit. That's a big challenge in 2026. And again, I'm afraid it's going to be a big challenge for all producers in 2027 as the supply chain gets sorted out.
Yeah, you know, I think this question, why should farmers be concerned about the rise in oil and gas prices, you know, specifically when it comes to farming operations?
Yeah, well, you're using a lot of diesel fuel out there in the field. And then again, you know, the sort of natural gas complex, that's the feedstock for nitrogen fertilizer. And so we're seeing the increases on the farm side. Now, we're also seeing a lot of concerns, or there's a lot of consumers who have this notion that farmers are somehow raking in these big profits because they're seeing the cost of food rise at the grocery store. Well, the farmer is not controlling that. Most farmers in North Dakota this year are going to lose money. What's driving up those food prices is the cost of fuel to ship that food across the country. That food, that commodity, that all has to move. A lot of it moves on truck, it moves on rail. That requires fuel. And that's one of the big drivers of those challenges right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned tariffs earlier. So, last year, tariffs were a big topic of discussion among many businesses, including farming. Did the tariffs have a larger impact than expected on North Dakota farmers, or a smaller one?
I think that the impact of the China trade dispute in particular had a marked impact on North Dakota soybean growers. And I think when we look at the soybean complex, you know, about 75%, about three quarters of the world's soybean crush capacity is in the United States, Argentina, Brazil, and China. Well, the three biggest producers of soybeans are the United States, Brazil, and Argentina. And so there's a lot of competition for that Chinese market. And when we restrict access to that, that's a big hit to producers. I think the other challenge is most of our trade is oriented to the Pacific Northwest. Now, some of that got redirected. There were a lot of co-op elevators around the state that were really trying to find new shipping channels and were successful in some of that. But that ultimately led to an increase in basis, a wider gap between the futures price and the local price. And so the soybean price, the futures price, was depressed. But then we also saw that farmers were losing more of that price off basis than typical. We saw basis up to $1.60 in some places. And it was a very challenging year. Now, things with China seem to have stabilized. We've seen some improvements in soybean prices and other commodity prices, but we really need that certainty. And we're seeing that maybe there's an agreement with China, but it doesn't seem like the U.S. and China are fully on the same page. People like certainty, businesses like certainty, farmers and ranchers like certainty, and we really need to drive towards a certain stable trade relationship with that critical market.
Yeah. Can you expand on how the Straits of Hormuz closure affects farming operations?
Well, you see a huge chunk of the world's nitrogen fertilizer moves through the Strait of Hormuz. Urea and hydrous ammonia, you're talking, you know, a third and 50% of those nitrogen fertilizers globally move through the Strait of Hormuz. So the closure of the strait caused global nitrogen fertilizer prices to rise. Now, in the United States, we actually don't get any anhydrous ammonia through the Strait of Hormuz. We don't get, it's 10-15% of our urea moves through the Strait of Hormuz. But when those global prices rise, the prices here at home rise. And we have been spending a lot of time trying to explore solutions to that problem. One, getting the Strait of Hormuz open is something we need to do in the short term. But we also see the level of consolidation in that industry and the opportunity for some of these really large companies to take advantage of market disruptions like that, really at the cost of the producer. That's something that we need to address here in the short term and something that we're pushing hard for in the next farm bill.
You mentioned certainty for farmers, but the Straits of Hormuz, closure, how does that compare to the tariffs that were introduced?
I think if you look historically, you look back to the first Trump administration, you look back to the first China trade war, the impact that we saw on our soybean market in 2025 and into 2026 was pretty similar. You know, you asked earlier, was it more than we expected? Well, we had a pretty good idea of what to expect because we'd seen that play before. I think the challenge now is we have the uncertainty, we have the instability in our trading relationships on the demand side. And then we have this pinch on the other side with our input costs. And so, you know, input costs are really high. Commodity prices are below break even. That's really the theme of 2026. But it's been a major challenge, and that's different from the trade war we experienced before, where most of that pressure was on the demand side. Now it's hitting farmers from both sides, and they're being squeezed in the middle.
Yeah, you know, is it, you know, certain crops more affected? You mentioned soybeans and corn, obviously, but are those the only ones affected, or can you talk more about that?
Well, the biggest demand shift, you know, when you look at China, the biggest demand implications are soybeans to China, of crops we grow up here in the Northern Plains. When you look at nitrogen fertilizer, the biggest impacts are corn, wheat, canola, those crops that use nitrogen fertilizer as a crop nutrient. And so, again, you know, that the Strait of Hormuz being blocked, the rapid and overwhelming increase that we've had in fertilizer prices, that's impacting farmers across the state of North Dakota. That impact is most severely felt by those corn and wheat farmers who are using a lot of nitrogen fertilizer to support and grow those crops.
Did you say, what is the amount of the world's fertilizer that's shipped through the Strait.
Yeah, so it's 30% and 50% of our urea and ammonia move through the Strait of Hormuz. But again, when you look at the U.S., we produce about 90% of our anhydrous ammonia here in the U.S. We produce about 2/3 of the urea here in the U.S. Now, in North Dakota, we have a unique challenge because we are at the end of the domestic supply chain. We're at the end of the supply chain, which means we're most vulnerable to rapid price increases. And so another one of our focuses is growing domestic production of those nitrogen fertilizers, so we're not having to import any of that, isolating ourselves from these geopolitical events in the global market. Doing more of that here in this state that is rich in natural gas, where we have the feedstock we need to produce nitrogen fertilizer.
Yeah, and of course, due to the lack of fertilizer available, how would this affect crop yielding?
Yeah, I think a lot of producers this year, you know, you have to look at this all happened early March. So there wasn't a lot of time to plan and to change. And so a lot of producers making those decisions on the fly. And if you were a farmer who happened to pre-book fertilizer at a price you were comfortable with, maybe you didn't change a lot. But there certainly were farmers there who maybe pre-booked, but it was still a pretty steep price. We walked into this year with pretty high fertilizer prices, who maybe lowered their application rates and is farming for a lower yield, who maybe switched crops and worked more legumes, more soybeans, more peas and lentils into the rotation to lower that requirement nitrogen fertilizer. I think there are a lot of different decisions that producers made this year, but I think the levers that producers pulled most frequently was switching to a crop with a lower nitrogen fertilizer requirement or lowering that requirement across the farm. And then I think the other would be lowering their application rates, farming for a lower yield.
Yeah, so there you're telling me that, you know, that North Dakota Farmers Union, though, how has the union responded to these challenges and how do you respond to your members?
Yeah. Well, I look at the situation that we're in right now, and I think the situation that's going to continue into next year. Input costs are too high. Commodity prices are too low. Farmers and ranchers are shouldering record debt loads. And we have far too much uncertainty in the markets that we buy from and sell to. And so we have been advocating very strongly for policies that boost domestic demand for the commodities we produce. We know that we're facing more competition in these global markets. We know those global markets are more unstable. And so we want to grow domestic demand through policies like year-round E15, something that's moving through Congress, by updating the RFS to have higher renewable volume obligations to grow soybean demand. We're advocating for policies in this next farm bill that will actually address input costs, like policies that bring more transparency to our fertilizer market, that grow domestic demand. And we are advocating for more fair and competitive markets. We cannot, this environment where farmers are being squeezed on both sides by heavily consolidated markets is not a sustainable environment for us.
Yeah. You know, have farmers experienced challenges like this in the past, or are we in uncharted waters here?
Well, family farmers and ranchers are a resilient bunch. And certainly, we have faced challenges in the past. I think every sort of cycle, the challenge is a little bit different. Again, I think one of the things that differentiates the challenges we're facing today is that we have the uncertainty on both the input side and on the crop price side. I think that's unique from some of the challenges we've seen in recent memory. But certainly, there's a lot of producers out there who started farming during the 1980s farm crisis. Right, high debt loads, not as high as we have today, and that's an important point, but really tough solvency situations. We're going to get through this. We're going to support each other. We're going to make sure that we have each other's backs, and we're going to make sure that we have policies that reflect modern agriculture, the challenges that we face today, instead of outdated policies that reflect the way agriculture operated 25 years ago.
Yeah, you know, how do obstacles like this affect newer farmers? Does it disincentivize people from looking into going into agriculture?
You know, agriculture is a dynamic industry. I don't think we give ourselves enough credit for, you know, the technology and a lot of the exciting developments happening in agriculture. But if you're a young farmer, if you're a young rancher, certainly you want stability in that industry. Certainly you don't want to have overwhelming debt loads hanging over your head your entire career. And so I think that there are a lot of young producers who are still trying to make it work. They're still trying to enter the industry. You know, we haven't talked a lot about the cattle side, but cattle prices are really high right now, which creates a challenge for young producers actually getting in and building their herd because it costs a lot to buy those replacement heifers. I think the bottom line is we need to have policies that support those producers for the long term, policies that are oriented to the current and future environment in agriculture. And I hope that this is an exciting industry full of a bunch of wonderful, great people. I hope that a lot of young producers recognize that and embrace that.
Yeah. Are there solutions to offset the financial impact? I know farmers take out insurance, but the farm bill's out there always. Are there solutions to it?
Well, certainly we have the farm safety net. So we have our counter-cyclical programs, ARC and PLC. We have a pretty robust crop insurance program now, and that takes really manages a lot of the yield risk and helps protect producers or helps producers protect themselves from a lot of that yield risk. There are farm loan programs that need to be updated in this next farm bill. So are there programs that support producers? Yes. I think one of our concerns is long term, we have shifted to a much heavier reliance on ad hoc or emergency programs. We have updates to the farm safety net that were advanced in the reconciliation package last summer. We advocated for those. But ultimately, I think we've recognized it's not enough. And there's a farmer bridge assistance program. Congress is talking about needing to provide more relief. The uncertainty and the unsustainability of our approach to those ad hoc programs creates a lot of challenges. We need a stronger, more stable safety net that they can rely on long term.
We are out of time, but if people want more information about North Dakota Farmers Union or farming in general, where can they go?
Well, folks can find out about all the work that we're doing at NDFU at www.ndfu.org. And really appreciate the opportunity to visit with you about these important issues.
Matt, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks a lot.
That's Prairie Public's CEO John Harris on Prairie Pulse with Matt Perdue, the president of the North Dakota Farmers Union. This is Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. For generations, the Marquise de Mores has been remembered in North Dakota as the colorful founder of Medora, an ambitious entrepreneur and a larger-than-life frontier figure. But a new biography is prompting historians to take a fresh look at his legacy and raising difficult questions about how history is remembered. In this edition of Plainsfolk, Dr. Tom Ezern explores why myths surrounding the Marquise deserve another look.
In sublime overview of the valley of the Little Missouri River, in the Badlands of North Dakota, stands a simple but elegant residence from the 1880s known as the Chateau de Mores. As a historian, I have a little bit of a problem with anachronism here. You see, I can uncover no evidence that people in the territory ever called this place the Chateau de Mores. In his biography of the Marquis de Mores, historian Jerry Tweeten says the residence was called the Chateau by the press and local folks. There is no footnote for that. I can say for sure the press made no such usage, and there is no record of local folks, and really I hate that phrase, using it. There was no Chateau de Mores, but there was a Chapeau de Mores, which is to say, the hat of the Marquis de Mores. When he emerged as the leader of anti-Semitic proto-fascism in Paris during the 1890s, following his misadventures in Dakota in the 1880s, the Marquis made it part of his personal branding to wear a Western-style broad-brim hat, the Chapeau de Mores. There he is, in his chapeau, on the cover of the new biography by Sergio Lizzaro, First Fascist, the sensational life and dark legacy of the Marquis de Mores. I do not find the Lizzaro biography authoritative about the Marquis's years in the territory. He doesn't know about land and cattle, But then, neither did Moraes. Heck, he even failed in the sheep business, in which countless other absentee owners profited. What Luzzatto does is detail the despicable origins of French fascism, centered on Moraes and on his contemporary, Edouard Drumont. Luzzatto also finds the actions of Moraes in Dakota Territory, cavalier disregard for others to the point of homicide, heedless spending, general fecklessness in management, consistent with his whole life trajectory. The first book-length biography of Moraes dates from 1970, the University of Oklahoma Press, entitled The Marquis de Moraes, Emperor of the Badlands. It is, as evident from the title, a puff piece. Suffice it to say, this was not a shining moment for a great publisher of literary nonfiction. Soon after came The Marquis de Moraes, Dakota capitalist, French nationalist, by North Dakota's own Jerome Tweeten, published by the Institute for Regional Studies, 1972. It's a pretty good biography, written from the standpoint of the American West, and it relates in matter-of-fact fashion some of the Marquis's political debasements in France, but it goes light on them. And it doesn't have the archival evidence used by Luzzatto. So that's all just historiography, and of interest perhaps only to scholars in their seminars. But we in North Dakota also have invested heavily in a positive mythology around the Marquis de Moraes. The so-called chateau is the jewel in the crown, monarchical overtones intended, of our state historic sites. When we put it on the National Register of Historic Places in 1972, after publication of the Tweeten biography, we said its significance lies in its status as a memorial to the man who built it, because therein is related a remarkable story of the development of the West and the diversity of the people who settled it and tamed it and made it a productive part of this nation. Now, then we have the bronze statue of the Marquis, sent from France by two of his sons, installed on a high pedestal in a park in Medora. The author of the National Register nomination for the park in 2018 left us, I suspect intentionally, a clue as to what we should think. She points out that prior to its unveiling in 1927, Jerry Tweeten's local folks set fire to it. We can no longer feign innocence of all that the Marquis de Moraes represents.
Dr. Tom Easern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University and a regular contributor to Main Street. His Plainsfolk commentaries explore the people, places, and stories that continue to shape the history and culture of the Northern Plains. Still ahead on Main Street, new federal restrictions on a herbicide are designed to reduce spray drift, but many think the regulations won't change much. That's ahead. Stay with us. This is Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Dicamba has become one of the most controversial herbicides in American agriculture. Farmers say it's an important tool for controlling tough weeds, while neighbors and conservation groups point to widespread damage from spray drift that can harm crops, trees, and other plants. New EPA regulations are now in effect, but many experts say they won't resolve the long-running conflict, Harvest Public Media reports.
On Kevin Johnson's farm in eastern Illinois near the Indiana border, weeds can be a really big issue. He and his family grow corn and soybeans, and they care a lot about the soil. Instead of tilling the field to kill weeds, Johnson relies on a mixture of herbicides, including dicamba.
We have to have every tool in the toolbox. Weeds are not getting easier to kill.
Dicamba is a potent weed killer, but the problem with this herbicide is that some crops are extremely sensitive to it. Grapes, tomatoes, and some trees can all be killed. Even soybeans and cotton that have not been genetically modified are at risk. Dicamba can drift in the wind, and after it's been sprayed above a certain temperature, it can vaporize and travel for miles. Aaron Hager is a weed science professor at the University of Illinois.
It's never really a question about if we'll see the symptomology of off-target movement. We just don't know how extensive it'll be. because we can't really predict what the temperature is going to be.
And that's why Hager says dicamba can be such a contentious topic, even among farmers.
You know, the dicamba mindset among end users or non-end users was like the 2016 presidential election. You were in one camp or the other, and if you weren't in my camp, you were wrong.
The EPA calls the new regulations for spraying dicamba on cotton and soybeans the strongest ever. Hager says in some ways they are stricter. For example, they don't allow dicamba to be sprayed if it's hotter than 95 degrees. But the EPA also dropped rules that prevented it from being applied after June. Purdue University weed scientist Tommy Butts says farmers need to control weeds, but he has mixed feelings about dicamba.
We have to do certain strategies to reduce drift, which are really important, but then that's also shooting our weed control in the foot, and so we're losing here too. So that's why I say I always have a love-hate relationship with it right now, because we're stuck in the middle with a lot of balancing acts, and there's no good answer across the board.
Even outside the agricultural community, dicamba can be a problem. In some rural towns, the signs of dicamba drift are apparent if you know where to look.
Once you see it, you can't unsee it.
In a public park in Tilden, Illinois, Kim Ernt-Pitcher has noticed the leaves on the bur oak trees are curled and cupped around the edges.
They're also just misshapen. You can see that even some of the tips are folded and some of them are severely stunted.
Ernt-Pitcher is the director of Ecological Health for Prairie Rivers Network, a conservation nonprofit. She's been documenting drift damage across Illinois for 9 years now. She says dicamba stresses trees and even kills others. Previous iterations of the EPA rules, called labels, have been shot down in federal court, and Ernt-Pitcher doesn't expect these new rules to break the cycle.
Over and over, the courts have dealt with this issue, and we've had extremely technical, long labels to follow, and it's still causing injury, and it's really frustrating to see it come back.
Back on the farm in eastern Illinois, Johnson says he's sympathetic to those with concerns about dicamba. He and his neighbors plant dicamba-resistant soybeans in adjacent fields to avoid drift problems. To him, the key comes down to communication.
And I think we're getting better to that, but up until that point, I don't think everybody was having a conversation. We wave at each other, stuff like that, as neighbors, but you gotta have those conversations. Now, nobody loves those conversations, but you gotta have those conversations.
Johnson says he wishes there was a better chemical to use, but for now, they have to work with what they have. I'm Will Bauer, Harvest Public Media.
Support for Harvest Public Media comes from listeners like you. Harvest Public Media reports on food systems, agriculture, and rural issues throughout the Midwest and Great Plains.
What do you do on a Saturday morning? Maybe you're getting your children ready for a baseball game, or in the winter for hockey. Maybe you're warming up to the day with a cup of coffee. Well, why not pair that ritual with a rewarding listening experience? Hi, I'm Scott Simon. You can join me on Weekend Edition Saturday for enlightening conversations with artists and writers. Speaking of sports, you'll hear plenty about that too. I'm a fan, and of course, when news breaks, either here at home or around the world, we catch you up and provide clarity. It's NPR member stations like Prairie Public, where you'll find Weekend Edition Saturday and all the NPR programs that you enjoy and on which you depend. Member stations also depend on listeners like you to help provide this free public service that adds value to your weekend. Please lend a hand with whatever you can by making a donation at prairiepublic.org. Thank you, North Dakota.
How space weather can make it rain or not. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Western Europe has been experiencing a heat wave so widespread and severe, it is the worst ever. And human-caused climate change is to blame, according to experts.
A heat dome, an area of high pressure that traps heat and humidity, has parked over the region for days like a lid on a pot, leading to temperatures higher than average across southern England, France, Germany, Italy, and Spain. As the heat wave spreads east, Poland, the Czech Republic, and Slovakia are bracing for record temperatures.
In France, the average day and night temperatures across dozens of places hit 86 degrees Fahrenheit, the highest since records began about 80 years ago. At the end of last week, no fewer than 40 people in France had drowned, many of them trying to cool off in rivers and canals in risky places or not knowing how to swim. People are using chalk to cover their windows to let in some light but reflect the heat.
In the UK, people were checking into hotels with air conditioning, and searches for accommodations with AC had tripled since the first of the month, especially for parents with newborn babies looking for cool rooms. In London, ironically, several Climate Action Week events had to be canceled because of extreme heat.
Germany recorded its highest temperature ever at nearly 107 degrees Fahrenheit. 11 highways were affected, including the country's famed Autobahn, which buckled open in two places. Railroads told people not to take non-essential trips because the heat was severely affecting infrastructure.
A report out last week, focused on Europe, shows that human-caused climate change is making days and nights hotter. The World Weather Attribution Organization concludes that temperatures reached in Western Europe would have been virtually impossible 50 years ago.
The team of international scientists who analyze how extreme weather is affected by global warming report that a similar June heat wave 50 years ago would have been almost 6.5 degrees Fahrenheit cooler, and had one occurred in 2003, it would have been 3.6 degrees cooler.
They add that we are reaching the extent of our ability to cope with increasing extreme heat, and that events occurring in Europe are tens to hundreds of times more likely to happen since the early 2000s. The organization stresses that a rapid phase out of fossil fuels is critical to avoiding higher temperatures and their consequences.
Meanwhile, in the U.S., just ahead of the July 4th holiday, a heat dome is likely to develop over a large part of the country, from Minneapolis to Atlanta. Temperatures will range in the 90s to low 100s with high humidity, according to NOAA.
Everybody talks about the weather, but nobody does anything about it. That famous quote, mistakenly attributed to Mark Twain, may have new meaning for a type of weather that has many scientists concerned, so-called space weather.
Space weather is driven by giant explosions on the sun called solar flares, which can block radio communications here on Earth and fry satellite electronics.
Space weather is also generated by geomagnetic storms caused by variations in solar winds, which can interrupt GPS signals and spark surges that overload power grids. The sun is currently at the peak of an 11-year cycle, and activity is at its highest.
The threat posed by space weather is the subject of much international research and ongoing U.S. legislation. In 2020, the Space Weather Bill was signed into law, which directs several government agencies, including NOAA and NASA, to collaborate on mitigating space weather hazards. A House committee will address the topic on July 1st.
Meanwhile, new research from the University of New Hampshire found that solar and geomagnetic storms, which typically last for around a day, can exert profound and immediate impacts on Earth's weather.
Lead author Jakob Rieder found that geomagnetic storms significantly influence atmospheric pressure, temperature, and precipitation.
In the hours and days following a solar storm, he says that parts of North America can see sharp changes in weather, and the more powerful the solar storm, the more dramatic the shift.
The study combined 67 years of hourly data capturing the intensity of geomagnetic storms over North America, as well as hourly atmospheric data during the same period.
In the study, Rieder saw surprising patterns. Regions like Canada's Hudson Bay and the Rocky Mountains in the western U.S. showed notable drops in rainfall and snowfall following solar storms. Even more intriguing, large solar storms that strike in the summer or winter appear more likely to suppress precipitation than those occurring in spring or fall.
Rieder suspects that's because electromagnetic radiation from the solar flares penetrate through the Earth's lower atmosphere by way of the polar vortex, the large area of low pressure and cold temperature at the poles.
While this research won't change the daily weather forecast just yet, Reeder says the sun's activity should be factored into climate models to sharpen long-term projections. That way, we might be able to heed that famous witticism about the weather and actually do something about it.
That's it for This Week in Water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Long as I remember, the rain been coming down.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Kelly Corrigan Wonders. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Jill Freitas. A new University of Arizona study found that American Indians operate 62% of farms in Arizona and manage more than 80% of the state's total agricultural land. But those farmers are still not getting the recognition or resources they need. Michael Kotutwa Johnson is a Hopi dry farmer and a co-author of the study. KJZZ's Lauren Gilger spoke with Kotutwa Johnson about the findings and the future of indigenous agriculture.
62% of all the farms in the state operated by Native Americans, 81% of the state's total agricultural land, tribal land. I mean, this is a massive footprint. And I wonder, like, how did we not know this before? Were you surprised by these results?
I was very surprised. But, you know, it's not too surprising because, you know, tribes, the 22 federally recognized tribes in Arizona sit on about a fourth of the acreage of land in Arizona. So that's pretty much what it is. But like I said, I don't think people really understand the agricultural imprint and footprint that we have here in Arizona and have since almost like to say time immemorial.
I've been out to your farm on the reservation, interviewed you about your work there and watched how you do this kind of amazing thing, growing this crop with almost no water sometimes, whatever comes down from the sky. And it's got this long cultural history that it is rooted to. So, I mean, obviously that's part of your motivation here and part of what you're trying to do with not just this study, but with your entire body of work, right?
Yes, it is. You know, my big body of work is called the revitalization of the American Indian food system. And why is that so important? Because, you know, you have one reservation here that has about an 80% diabetic rate, which is the biggest in the globe. And you also have another one, which I saw congressional testimony on, that the life expectancy rate is only 52 years old. So you combine those two factors in the health of the people. It's one of the reasons why I like this study, because it brings all the data necessary so that we can maybe get a bigger pot of the pie, not necessarily all for economic gain, but turn the health numbers of our people around so that they have a long life expectancy rate and not such high rates of diabetes and heart disease.
Yeah. And you're debunking this idea that tribal agriculture, or I guess tribal economy in general, is not having any kind of economic impact on the state. Like, it's in fact having a very big one, it seems.
Yes, it is. You know, and I think that's one of the things that, you know, the Farm Bureau first kind of brought attention to some of these numbers, and they're a very good outfit. But, you know, the state's Department of Agriculture also should pay attention to this, because, you know, when we talk about money, we heard about there's a $3 billion agricultural industry in Yuma. We've always been here, and it's just sometimes we need a little bit more recognition than what we're currently receiving for our agricultural ventures.
When you look toward the future of Native American agriculture in the state, it looks like, I mean, you're anticipating it to be an even bigger part of the pie. Does that have to do with big ag? Does that have to do with tribal water rights?
Well, a lot of it has to do with tribal water rights. You know, tribal water rights under one of the agreements, some of the tribes in Southern Arizona are actually allowed 60% of the CAP. They're allowed to utilize that much, but they don't. I think it's more about what farmers can do and cannot do with a limited amount of water supply, especially now that we have the lower and upper basin negotiating for new allocations and new water rights that's well underway.
So, I mean, the study, you say you want it to serve as a baseline going forward. What do you hope for the future in terms of research in this area?
Well, it's not so much the research, it's just more the participation. You know, whether you know this or not, we have this thing called the Federally Recognized Tribal Extension Program. It's a 4-year program every year that allows us to put tribal agricultural extension agents, kind of like my job, on the various reservations, but we only have 5 out of the 22. And these people are key in order to start like community gardens, to help find the needs of the tribe, to start programs that would help with tribal agriculture. But I would sure like to find a way that the state could step in and also allocate funds, because look how much we're helping the state, not only in our agricultural revenues, but our gaming revenues in water that we're helping with municipalities that are paying near to nothing for accessing tribal water. So we need to figure out a best way to not only help their community, but also help the tribal community. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the most important thing.
All right. Dr. Michael Kotutwa Johnson, a Dry Hopi farmer, co-author on this study, as well as assistant professor and cooperative extension specialist of indigenous resilience at the University of Arizona, joining us. Thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Jill Freitas for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 7th. If something is considered excellent, the phrase, the greatest thing since sliced bread, comes to mind. But there was a time before sliced bread. Bread was sold in loaves of different sizes and shapes. It might come in long loaves or round loaves. Consumers purchased a loaf and had to slice it when they got home. This resulted in uneven slices and took time and effort. Recipes that used bread included instructions on how to slice it. A recipe in a March 1928 newspaper included directions to slice bread 1 to 2 inches thick. Then something amazing happened. On this date in 1928, sliced bread was introduced to consumers. Otto Frederick Rohweder invented the first machine for commercially slicing bread. The first commercial sale was made by a bakery in Chillicothe, Missouri. It was billed as the greatest step forward in the baking industry. Sliced bread was not an immediate hit with consumers. The sliced loaves looked sloppy and went stale faster than whole loaves. A system was developed to wrap the loaves and keep them fresh, but consumers were still bewildered. Instructions on one wrapper informed customers that they needed to open the wrapper at one end and remove as many slices as desired. Once the problems of sloppy-looking and stale loaves were solved with the wrapper, sliced bread caught on. Housewives loved the convenience of not having to slice bread by hand, and since slicing a loaf by hand resulted in uneven slices, they appreciated knowing exactly how many slices were in a commercially sliced loaf. Producers also loved the results, as consumption increased because people ate more bread when it was convenient. When sliced bread was first sold, shoppers might find only one or perhaps two brands on the shelves. Today, the variety is staggering, and commercially produced bread is a staple in most American kitchens. Consumers can choose from white, wheat, and rye breads, as well as rolls and muffins. The bakery industry includes bagels, cookies, cakes, and pies, but the largest segment is still sliced bread. Agriculture is the leading industry in North Dakota, and wheat is a major crop. North Dakota wheat plays a significant role in the baking industry. Hard spring wheat and durum wheat are especially favored for their high protein content and baking qualities. The introduction of sliced bread was a boon to North Dakota farmers. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by the Study ND, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting art programming here on Prairie Public.
President Trump is in Ankara for the NATO summit, where he met with the Turkish president. Following the meeting, Trump said he would soon decide whether to sell F-35 fighter jets to Turkey despite a congressional ban. Trump's relationship with NATO countries and the international deals he's making on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that wraps up this Tuesday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, North Dakota cities are at the center of some of the state's biggest opportunities and toughest challenges. Matt Gardner, Executive Director of the North Dakota League of Cities, joins us to discuss the issues shaping municipalities, large and small, what city leaders are hearing from residents, and why strong local government is essential to North Dakota's future. Plus, the Red River Market returns to downtown Fargo. That's all ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.